The planet itself is now a museum. And since Sputnik. And this is only the beginning. All other museums are now obsolete.
What would you say, Marshall, about the idea that, you know, the museum as a kind of gathering point of what man has done?
Why not consider the meaning of the word? The Garden of the Muses.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the rallying of all the arts into one focal point.
Well, I would.
That's what the word means.
Yeah, of course. Do you know the comment that Peter Swan made about this thing in Toronto when Sam Zaks bought up the whole collection
of Henry Moore?
Of Henry Moore. Peter Swan's comment was, "Modern sculpture?"
Would rather.
When Sam Zaks offered him two of the Moores.
Like any curator, he will never be seen dead with a living work of art.
That's right. This is my comment, actually. That curators are people who live with dead art and wouldn't be caught dead with living art. And this seems to be a kind of pervasive idea in the museum world.
However, the museum concept is a consumer concept. It is not an art concept. And art is for the sake of opening doors of perception. And museums are for the opposite purpose of closing
That's
the doors
right.
of perception.
Yeah. Well, museums are totally dedicated to the idea of the object, per se, you know, the object.
Classified and packaged.
That's right.
That's
yeah.
the object, not as a means of perception.
Well, Marshall, I've watched them.
But as a package deal.
Yeah. I have watched them take a beautiful thing and put a number on it and put it up in the attic.
But remember, this is...
At that point, they solved the problem.
Sorry, Harley, but by the way, Tony, are we recording?
Yes.
Okay, let's go.
You know, we can edit
now,
it later. Tony
night,
will edit it later.
The other night on, was it Channel 13 or one of the current shows, they had a magnificent story of auctioning of modern art.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they encountered the problem of the genuine fake. The work of art that is so beautifully faked that most experts are taken in. And from the point of view of the auctioneer, these are the obscenities that must be destroyed because they drag down the value of the genuine works. Now, as they went on to say, this, of course, has nothing to do with the artist. And if a work of art is faked to the point where it has genuine structure and means of awakening perception to form, then obviously it performs the same function as the original and has the same value as the original. And its monetary or market value is totally irrelevant. But this is not the way the museum collector or classifier would observe such an object.
That's
it
right.
never occurred to these people that these objects have a function beyond that of classified, packaged, mm-hmm. excellent.
Well, of course, this came up with Van Meegeren during the war, where Van Meegeren sold these Vermeers to the Nazi hierarchy, and he just sat up in an attic and painted them. Then, at the end of the war, what happened was they slapped him in jail for a legal enterprise of some kind or another. And he said to them, look, I wasn't trading in Vermeers. I was trading in faked Vermeers.
And he was not reproducing works that Vermeer had ever painted.
That's right.
He was creating new Vermeers.
Mm-hmm.
It's like somebody being punished for writing new Shakespearean plays that Shakespeare had never thought of.
Yeah, that's right. What would happen, actually? It's a tremendous idea. What would happen if somebody... Well, it did happen, actually. Remember early English, remember the tremendous farce, the tremendous fraud of somebody producing very, very early English literature. I don't know if you know about this. Do you remember?
Yes, in the 18th century, there was quite a big lot of faking of early Anglo-Saxon.
Yeah.
Of course, to the 20th century scholar's eye, it was not a very good fake. But the kind of antiquarianism took on a tremendous new meaning about the 18th century. The first big consumer age.
Yeah, I think this is, of course, the whole thing
the
is...
classification and collection of antiquities.
Package and not process. Package and not process.
And also antiquities.
Yeah.
The idea of the mildewed object being far superior to anything current.
Mm-hmm.
This, of course, went along with the romantic interest in ruins and in primitivism. Ossian, MacPherson's Ossian was a colossal fake of Celtic antiquities.
Yeah.
Which even got Napoleon all excited. He was a fan of this fake Gaelic masterpiece. Fingal's Cave. By the way, you've got yourself a swell set of overtones for us.
Vibrations in here.
Holy cow.
Listen to the vibration of that truck, eh?
Well, anyway, museums make, when Hardy and I once sat down to wait for some curator to come to our rescue in a museum. Where was that, Tom?
At the Museum of Natural Science.
I said, all right, Harley, you know that everyone who enters a museum suddenly gets claustrophobic. Now, why? Why is this horrible shut-in feeling suddenly assail the human sensibilities in a museum? Let's work it out. We got a few minutes. And so we just sat there and chatted about it. We solved the problem in 3 or 4 minutes. And the reason is this, and the concern's on the very heart of our matter. Museums are laid out in a continuous visual space, connected space. They have like a storyline at a World's Fair. You've got a route to follow.
But the artifacts have no relationship.
The artifacts themselves are iconic, each making its own world, and they have nothing to do with the space in which they're exhibited.
This is the big
problem. Clash between the iconic spaces created by the artifacts and the visual spaces in which they're set creates a horrible trauma in the viewer.
You see, there is a dichotomy here between the whole idea of space as something into which you put things. You create the space and you put things in it. That's what museums are. But this is not true about most of the cultures of the world. Because what happens in most cultures is that you have the object and it creates its own space.
Well, for example, until Newton's time, it was assumed by all mankind that the eye was a broadcasting system that created the outer world that we saw. The apple of the eye was that center from which emerged all the images that created the outer world. This is the meaning of the phrase, the apple of the eye. In the psalmist says to God, keep me in the apple of thine eye. Keep me on the program. Keep me in existence. Don't scrub me off that there tape, please. The apple of the eye was the broadcasting center. Come Newton or afterwards, people suddenly reversed this and began to think of the eye as a reception center. Not as a making center, but as a matching center. Now, in all other societies, the idea of the eye as a maker of space and a maker of the outside world applies to all the other senses as well. The ear and touch and all these senses create their own spaces and their own worlds also. Smell. But the idea of man as a mere consumer, the tabula rasa, came in the 18th century. The idea that man was merely a container for sensations that poured into him.
Yeah. I think this is apropos, Marshall, of my theory about déjà vu. The déjà vu thing has been thought about for a long time as at some point or another. You have two cows in a field with grass or something or another, and this reminds you of something about two cows. And it isn't true. I'm postulating at this point that A deja vu is a reconstruction, an exact correspondence of the orchestration of the senses at some point or another. It has nothing to do with content. It has to do with the fact that the olfactory, the touch, the eye are in a certain ratio. This is what deja vu is about.
It's also kind of rearview mirror.
Oh, yeah, but it's...
situations that match...
Well, mirror is a bad word there because this suggests the visual immediately, you see. I don't think it's a...
No.
It's a... If you think about the total sensorium and you think about the possibility of reorchestration
Tell
of that...
Tell me, I take it that you're part of this dialogue. For heaven's sake, let's make it a trialogue, eh?
All right, I'm interested in the... Let me just get over with you on this. Firstly, there's something very interesting. Before you started talking, before you said we're on tape, you two were talking in the perfect manner for stereo.
Okay.
In that you were rubbing up against each other, which just is so exciting. It calmed down a little when you said we're talking for tape, and you became more interested in the content of what you were saying to some degree.
Well,
we
began to.
Then you came back to it very
okay,
nicely.
We'll get back. Hey, we're on air, on the air, as it were.
Tell this me. Is something. Yeah, I don't have this.
All right.
I couldn't care less whether I'm on tape,
now,
you know?
Well, I'm conscious of these environmental sounds. By the way, the word environment is a very important word for your purposes.
Caravallo, eh?
Peripallo, Greek word means to hit from all sides at once.
That's environment.
It's a number.
All right, let me ask several questions in relation to this. The museums are becoming more and more obsolete and yet more crowded.
No, just a moment. They're changing completely. They're taking in more and more of the cultural field in which the artifacts originally were created. They're paying less and less attention to mere classification. Anthropology has increasingly taken on this ecological scope, the total field of operation in which the objects were used and made. Whereas this is new and this is far more satisfactory in terms of perception.
Well, Ted Carpenter was remarking the other day that what had happened was that the film has just totally outmoded all the past archaeology.
Anthropological
descriptions in terms of type and, you know, in terms of writing.
Because the natives themselves are now permitted to make movies off their own rituals, their own daily lives, off their own methods of making, weaving, and cooking, and so on. And they don't correspond to anything the anthropologists have seen.
Have ever seen before, or have ever written before. This is, Ted tells about the film that was made by these people. They merely described,
leave the door up.
What they did was they got an old woman who had been making rugs all her life, you know.
Indian. And Navajo.
Yeah. And they got her to make a film of it. They showed her how to run a camera, you know.
She had never seen a film.
Never seen a film. Taught her how to run a camera. And she moved in, and the result was this, that she used the eye of the camera as a kind of finger that was concerned with the whole tactile bit of making these kind of rugs. And it was a totally new kind of film, suddenly.
Whereas the Westerner or the literate man uses the camera as an eye that looks at an operation. The native uses it as a hand.
Yeah, and of course one of the things inherent in the technology of television is that it is a scanning finger, not an eye, that produces
television. Let's go back to the... museum thing. I think we've done our bit by the museum world, haven't we? That they have moved from mere classification of antiquities to increasing ecological concern with scope, environment on which the objects were used or developed, purposes for which they were originally used.
I would say the direction is there, yeah.
Yeah. For example, the igloo is a very recent object in Eskimo culture. It doesn't go back very far. The white man was responsible for it.
It was the primostole, wasn't it? Primostole
made it possible to live in these ice cubes. But it also created the situation whereby there was a lot of drip from the roofs of the igloo. So the Eskimos took to pasting magazine pages over the sides of the igloo. And this led the anthropologist to crane his neck vigorously around so he could see these pages. This sent the natives, or the Eskimos, into fits of laughter. They could see just as easily upside down or sideways as right side up. The idea that these miserable anthropologists couldn't see except right side up just entertained them endlessly.
Well, Ted tells a story, actually, that he was in this kind of an environment where there were photographs from life or from whatever, from time and so on, upside down. And Ted sort of stood and put his head down between his legs, you know, and so he could see right side up on these things. And apparently the Eskimo kids imitated him for days and found this hilarious, you know. And they all the Eskimo kids went around with their heads between their legs looking at upside down things.
But, you know,
but there is no upside down in Eskimo art.
Nor in child art. If you have on the wall here pictures that are slightly askew or upside down, you'll automatically crane your neck to enable to be able to see them. But children don't have to do this, and natives don't have to do it. They see them exactly as they are from any angle. However, in terms of the museum as a situation, a humanly prepared situation, I'd like to draw attention to the fact that with Sputnik, as you put an information environment around the planet, the planet itself becomes a museum object, which can be photographed from other spaces.
Right.
And the first photographs from the moon have revealed that there's no life on the planet.
No life possible on the planet. This is what the photographs from the moon say. It's impossible to have life on Earth. You know, just isn't there.
It's like the old man.
Has anyone made that statement?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Official report.
Yeah.
But it's like the statement, the metaphysical question, is there a life before death? Well, I think we've done our bit by the
museum. I think you've done beautifully.
Let's turn to the real business.
Fine. What do we have on the agenda? We can just keep going. And,
well, we have these two slides and the dolly, which we can talk about.
You don't have a TV guide.
No, but I could run out and get one.
No, you can't. It's last week's.
Oh, a specific one. No,
it's June 8th.
Nope,
and believe me, it's Dali's greatest picture. I know it by heart.
Mm-hmm.
I had it carefully brought it with me, and thanks to the mess I've lived through in the last few
years. The Altamira one, the Buffalo one first.
The Buffalo one first?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Syrah is a different thing.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to take off.
Ah. No. Well, it might move to the... it's not upside down. It might move to the left. No, it moves to the right, I think.
Before we start recording on this, what do you think is the optimum time? 30 minutes?
Optimum time for what?
A usable half-hour disc.
Let's not worry about that. Let's decide that afterwards. Let's get our information.
Oh, we've got endless information. You go for hours.
All right, go for...
No, we don't. I
say go for the half hour, then.
But the point is this. Are we to imagine that our points will be dubbed and edited later to the advantage of the hearer? That you'll be able to provide other effects...
Well, I...
Or will there be just our voices?
I would say that depends on what you're talking about.
Well, you
and
see, we're talking...
That.
Well,
yes.
For example, suppose we're talking, as we will be talking, about tactile space, which is the space of the interval, and which therefore concerns music.
One could then illustrate it in various other forms.
So, and I think you'll find that many of the spaces we talk about will be capable of auditory effects.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you could... We wouldn't have to talk for half an hour for a half-hour disc. That's what I'm saying. Harley and I have this book coming out called Space and Poetry and Painting. And we don't have the text of the poems with us.
Damn. I could have brought those too. I didn't realize we needed them. You mentioned it, and I said no, but I...
See, we have primitive poems that go with the primitive spaces.
Well, I can remember some of them, Marshall.
Yeah, well, we'll use them, as we remember them. Mm-hmm. But they are very much like contemporary poetry. The Ferlinghetti world is very much like that of the Eskimo fair poem. Poesy concrete is very much like that of the old primitive poetry. And for the same reason. So we'll mention that.
Yeah.
But you see, in this book, we move through the spaces from primitive man to the present in both media, poetry and painting, or language and other plastic arts.
Mr. Leo? He's recording right now. I'll see if I can interrupt him.
Who? What time?
John Day of the New York Times asking the Marshal for. Oh.
Cut him off, Marshal.
Tell him to call back.
Mr. Leo, he's right in the midst of recording. Can you call back in about a half an hour or so? Thank you.
Yeah. One of the greatest lines that comes...
Sorry, you don't
want
to be
interrupted
about that.
Oh, no.
Well, one of the greatest lines that comes out of primitive poetry is out of the one in Eskimo that that Ted quotes.
Inurka. Which means the breath of life.
Yeah, and one of the greatest lines that comes out of it, which absolutely describes the business of...
Will you please make a note of it as you talk? Write it down so that we can refer to it as we record.
Oh, I see. No, I think we're recording right now, Marsh.
Oh, no, we haven't begun.
Yeah, I have the tape on.
The tape is on.
Oh, I see. I wanted to line this up a bit.
Okay, line it up. That's fine. One of the greatest lines, though, Marshall, is, "My house is made large by my guests." Mm-hmm. Remember this line?
Mm-hmm.
Tremendous. The number of your guests doesn't decrease the size of your house. It makes it bigger, you know? And this is the business of things creating spaces.
Harley, we don't have to raise our voices.
I'm sorry, I'm bothering you.
Let's chat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're not lecturing. And I mean, we want it that way. We don't want vehemence.
No, I was just remarking, though, that line, "My house is made large by my guests," is tremendous in terms of a recreation of the whole concept of space.
What about the line of Swingy Agonist? He's like, "I've got to use words when I talk to you," which is a way of saying that the language of the body of gesture is far richer than language used by a person who is endowed with the mimetic power. Anyway, we want to get really a number of discs, Tony, out of this book and put it, as it were, make it available, as it were, on disc. And after all, there are the texts, the paintings, and the poems. And the audience can buy the book and look at the poems and the paintings and have our commentary as it goes.
Mm-hmm.
So we start with cave painting.
We start with the Inurka thing.
And cave poetry. Because here is a space that is very little modified by human technologists.
Mm-hmm.
It's a space that involves the whole sensorium and was never intended to be looked at.
That's right. Well, of course, the whole world of the Eskimo is one of largely non-visual speeches.
But Altamira world, it represents a world of
parallel
plastic arts that were never intended to be seen by the human eye. They were done in the dark and in places where people were never expected to enter again.
Well, it's Gideon who makes this point, actually, that he had to crawl through all kinds of caverns to finally arrive at the point where the cave drawings were in Spain.
They were not only difficult of access, many of them painted under shelves of rock. utterly inaccessible. Many of them painted on very rough surfaces or uneven surfaces.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them painted many layers deep over each other. The art of photography has completely falsified the world of the cave painting.
Oh, well, and that happened before that, Marshall, actually. The Abbé Bruyère in the 19th century, imposed a 19th century visual realism upon these rock paintings, which didn't exist, but he falsified it in that way.
Well, they were never intended to be representations of anything. They were intended to affect operations going on in the outer world in a voodoo or magical
manner. That's right. That's right.
So they were operational objects, very much like those that come off the drafting boards of Madison Avenue advertising agencies. The closest parallel to the cave painter is the Madison Avenue ad agency, whose work is not intended to sharpen the perceptions of the viewer, nor to represent anything so much as to influence the will and purposes of the purchasing public. It is intended to have a magical effect upon the motives of a hidden audience. And so there is an amazing parallel between Madison Avenue and Altamira. And this is, of course, amusing and ironic, but it also draws attention to the fact that the greatest art of the 20th century in any quantitative plenary sense is the art of the advertiser. That by far the most ingenious and inventive art forms have come from the advertising world and perhaps the cartoonists of the 20th century, rather than from the professional painters. And this perhaps magnificently illustrated in that Salvador Dali painting recently on the cover of TV Guide for June 8.
Where he says the thumbs bit. He says, well, he says, what happens actually is that he takes the thumbs and he puts them into a kind of a desert. And they said, what kind of desert is this? He says, it's Dali Desert. This is where it occurs.
So yesterday you were asked, do you mean the Newton Minow Wasteland, TV Wasteland?
Yeah.
Oh, it's the
Dali Desert. And what he does is suggest that the TV screens are, there are images on the two thumbs.
The thumbnails. TV screens, yeah.
Yeah, they're TV screens. He says exactly the right shape for TV screens, thumbs.
And the thumbs are represented in very coarse textures, very, very tactile.
Yeah, with no relationship to a hand, incidentally. I mean, they just rise out,
And they are a considerable distance apart, mm-hmm. indicating tactile space, which is the space of the integral.
Yeah, and I think we can move in there on the statement of who was it who said to the blind all things are sight.
Alec Layton, the anthropologist, pointed out that touch in the world of the blind is not a continuum, does not reveal to the blind person a continuum such as the sighted encounter, but a world of discontinuities and sudden breakthroughs.
Yeah.
And suddenness of perception. Touch is not a world in which there is any continuity. But of course, this is true of sight, of hearing, and smell, and movement too.
But you could say actually that the only sense really that is connected is the sighted one. This allows the concept of continuity and perspective and backwards and forwards. And none of the other senses do this.
This sense, extended to time and the organization of human effort, creates the civilized world. The tribal man lives in no such space. He lives in acoustic space, which is a world in which sensation of sound comes from all directions simultaneously. It's a total sphere without center and without margins. This is the space of radio, of the telegraph press. It's a mosaic, all at once.
Do you remember
continuous world, no connections in a newspaper between any two items, but there is a dateline. There's the immediacy of involvement in now. And this is the space of Tribal Man and of Electric Man.
Do you remember the story the anthropologist told us? I've forgotten his name, in Toronto, who said he was working with Bushmen or somebody, some little tribe. And he took one of these characters out in a jeep, and he drove him through the forest where the man lived. And he took him down onto the plains. And when he got down after a day or so, he found that off to the left, about 2 or 3 miles away, there was a herd of buffalo. The native said, "What are those kind of insects over there?" Because the native had never seen more than about 30 feet away from himself before, living totally in the forest. He had absolutely and completely no sense of perspective. So the idea that off across that veldt there could be some...
Well, the eye sees all things right up against the face in any event.
Oh, yes. And this is where the child is.
When people recover sight after long years of blindness, when they're, by some operation, they're allowed to see again, the whole world is a buzzing, wilder confusion of immediate sensations stuck right in front of their eyes, all colors, all sorts of objects, all messed up.
But right in.
Page 51 of Otto Lowenstein's book, The Senses, reports this in detail and is simply a thrilling account of really how we see, unaided by other senses. The eye itself, merely unaided by the other senses, can see only flat up against the face. But to come back to the Dalí thing, Harley, he was drawing attention to the fact that TV is not a visual medium. But it is tactile.
That's right. Well, stress on the fingernail and the touch, the thing of the
scanning of the finger of the TV image is an iconic device that renders objects in structural outline and process rather than in photographic realism. And hence the involvement, also the rear projection. But then we're anticipating a little bit of Seurat there. Another feature, though, of the film, Salvador Dali TV picture, up in the right-hand corner, there's a bit of brain tissue. It looks like a little can of worms. Drawing attention to the fact that in the electric environment, we put our nervous system outside. Dali sees this quite clearly and manifests it by putting the brains, a portion of the human brains, right on the environmental horizon. Software, the electric information environment of software, is made of our own nervous systems. And it creates a new type of environment. Shall we pause, Tony?
No, I was had heard to go outside.
The amazing thing about the electronic man or the TV generation is that it lives in a world of software.
Okay.
It lives in a world of software created by its own nervous system as an environment. Whereas up till electricity, people lived in a world of hardware. Artifacts that extended portions of their bodies, but not their nerves. And the coming of the software environment, it creates the upsets for the ordinary civilized man. The TV generation has its personal image scrubbed or wiped away by this new software. And when it encounters the old hardware, it regards the hardware as the enemy, the thing that has caused this loss of identity.
Mm-hmm.
But that aspect of TV as tactile is very difficult to get people to recognize, because they think anything they can see must have all the characteristics of visual space or of uniform, continuous, connected space, Euclidean and so on.
Yeah.
Space of literate man.
Remember the quote I discovered some time back that Leonardo da Vinci used. He said, "Seeing is believing," but he did not quote the rest of it. Seeing is believing, but to touch is the word of God.
God's own truth.
God's own truth, you say. The touch is God's own truth.
Well, the idea of that touch involves all the senses and is therefore the most profoundly involving of experiences.
Oh, well, you know, biologically, I mean, we can prove this fact that in the developing fetus, the initial sensibility of the fetus is totally a ganglia, which is nothing but touch. And as the fetus develops, it moves out to these specialized receptors, like eye, ear, and so on.
And kinesis.
Yeah, and kinesis. But initially, it is nothing but touch.
Which is totally involving. So the TV generation is one that is profoundly involved and totally lacking in powers of detachment, objectivity, or direction, or goal orientation.
Right. We could even talk about Hearst at this point, Marshall. You know, Dr. Marshall and I, some years back, wrote a little thing which was never published called Why the TV Child Can't See Ahead. Because we were involved at that point with a chap named Arthur Hearst, Dr. Hearst, and he had discovered that the near point reading thing, bit, had come down to the point where children wrote, I think, at 4.5 inches and observed a book at 6 inches. And they also discovered that inasmuch as stereopsis is impossible at 6 inches, the best readers in the class, I think it was grade 3 or 4, the best readers were kids who were psychologically blinding one eye because stereopsis was impossible. You can't focus on this. Then he investigated in Texas in 1942 and discovered that the near point reading distance in Texas at that point was the classical one, elbow to ulna. And then he presented the problem to us at the center as to why, what is happening here? Why are the kids pulling the book right up to their faces? And Marshall and I postulated some time back, have you ever tried to walk between a small diaper kid and a TV screen? You know, he's right up there. So the children are trying to get that same
involvement
and quality of involvement that they get from the TV screen out of the book. This obviously demands a reorganization or a redesign and redevelopment of the whole concept of what is a book.
Typography needs to be quite different for a TV child.
That's right.
Has to take on the
and of course, this is what we're doing in Counterblast. In Counterblast, this is exactly what we're doing in this book.
Typography has to take on the character of a poster. But the apropos of the Salvador Dali painting, his awareness that TV is touch, and the touch is interval, not connection, and hence the world of the gap, brings in the whole musical phase of beat. Beat is touch. Beat creates interval. Interval demands closure. Closure creates rhythm. So the whole world of music is audio-tactile in the endless repetitive closing of gaps created by beat, up or down. Now this kind of a relation then between audio-tactile space is one which the beat generation, the rock generation, the whole hippie generation, the sitar, Shankar syndrome, all of these things show that Western man has lost his visual orientation.
That's right.
Is going inward. But this happened in the world of painting in the later 19th century.
That's right. Well, in the world of painting, of course, what we know about Japanese or Chinese painting is the stress was on the interval, not on the incident, but on the interval. And Chinese painting, for example, has what the Western world would regard as vast spaces in which there is nothing.
Well, the art of a flower arrangement in Japan consists in spaces.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember Takamura telling us that a Japanese housewife, when irritated with her husband, would never dream of verbalizing her grievance. She merely rearranges the flowers.
Isn't that beautiful? It's a thing, you know. But anyway, about this, I can quote the thing. Bless the Beatles for reaffirming that the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world.
There you go.
And that's very apt to one, honestly.
The beat.
Sure.
Is, the beatnik, what's the old saying? The beatnik is a rat. No.
No. No, the beatnik
is something that is chicken out of the rat race.
That's right. And he's a cat who's chicken out of the rat race.
He's a cat that is chicken out of the rat race. But Surah, your favorite.
No, about Surah, yeah, well, I...
Apropos TV.
Yeah. Well, of course, Surah, by using his techniques of divisionism and pointillism and so on, what he did was totally anticipate quadricolor reproduction and the whole bit of the technology of television, of color television.
He was painting television decades before there was...
That's right, in 1892.
Paul Klee was painting TV aerials decades before TV.
Yeah.
Calling them whistling machines and so
That's
on.
That's right. Forgot
Mozart and Bach were programming the Industrial Revolution by their metronomic beats a century before mechanical industry got rolling. And all artists anticipate the so-called realities by decades simply because they live in the now. Was it Wyndham Lewis who said art is a detailed history of the future? Because the artist is the only person who lives in the present. If you know how to see the present or sense the present, you can anticipate the future quite easily. The future of the future is the present, in other words.
Yeah, another way of saying it is that most men look at the past, extrapolate it into the present, under the illusion that they're looking at the future.
When Don Quixote became saturated with the new products of Gutenberg technology, medieval romances got into print right away, he rode off madly into the Middle Ages, seeking the enemy way, way back there.
Well, maybe, Marshall, we could talk briefly of this idea of abrasion, you know, historic
interface.
Yeah, of interface, and the fact that historically you can find that the periods of greatest creativity lie when or occur when one culture comes up against another. Remember our thing on Hieronymus Bosch, 15th century, where he's in the medieval thing, and he painted. Or he created the space of Renaissance times, which is a proscenium arch stage. And then he peopled it.
A real container.
Yeah, a real container. But then what he did was to people it with a kind of, or to
medieval
put in
icons.
Kind of medieval icons and all these strange monsters that he
and
put in there.
And created sheer horror.
That's right. The same thing happened when Kafka,
The Metamorphosis.
The Metamorphosis thing. What he did was create a very little mundane space in which the little clerk went down to work every day. And Kafka creates this space very carefully. And then suddenly, the little clerk turns into a cockroach.
The Metamorphosis
the same thing.
Of interface, one culture against another.
That's right.
At the present time, one of the greatest interfaces of all time, the new electric software interfacing with the old 19th century hardware, or the old Greek or Roman hardware, as far as that goes. The book is hardware. This interface creates such a loss of identity that the Kafka thing seems rather trivial.
Oh, yeah, but, I mean, he was writing quite a long while back. You know.
Our children today are dedicated to the proposition that the individual must cease. That private life and private identity is an evil thing, must be wiped out. And they take severe measures to attain this end by chemicals and by various aesthetic regimen. This desire, this is no, remember the sentimental primitivism of the, say, the Thoreau period. The mere nostalgic looking back to a tribal past is now a recreation in furious actuality of plenary tribalism by our own TV youngsters. The meaning of civilized, individual, private, detached, motivated, goal-directed man, finished, as far as they're concerned. They live lives of horror in a world of hardware, which they never made, while surrounded by worlds of software and information, which they have made, but they didn't know they put it there. Shakespeare's famous phrase about one touch of nature makes the whole world kin has a very sinister meaning. The phrase really goes, one touch of nature makes the whole world kin, that all, with one consent, pursue newborn gods, G-A-U-D-S, and give to dust that is a little guilt, more praise than guilt, or dusted. Any fancy bit of fuzz will gain more of their eulogy than the real thing. But men have never had the power to face reality. They've always been taken in by the dusty, showy, guilt-covered object. Humankind, as I just said, can bear a very little reality.
Well, this is a part of your remark, actually, that no one sees his environment, right? Same thing?
Joyce's phrase for it is at the top of page 81 in Finnegan. As for the viability of econols, they are, when invisible, invincible. The econol, or the environment, when unperceived, which is the normal state of such environments, exercises an invincible tyranny over the human sensorium. It twists and distorts every mode of perception without people even knowing what hit them.
That's right, but this then is the function of the artist.
The artist's job is to untangle that mess and to give clear images of what is really going on in the environment.
So that the artist, actually at that point, has a tremendous sociological
function.
Sure.
Survival function.
Without him,
Let me stop just for...
So here it is, this is McLuhan 2 years later in Tony Schwartz's studio again. The date is June 20th, 68. Okay.
Through a whole batch of their spatial orientations, their horror of maps and of street signs, et cetera, which, incidentally, is characteristic of a great deal of New York.
Okay. Well, I just said what Tony always says. I want to show you something.
Something of a concept. I'm saying I want to show. I want you to see this. Do you see what I mean?
Oh yes.
That's the context.
The moment.
I want to show it.
The moment.
I want you to see what I mean.
The moment of truth, of course, is not visual at all. It's just a blinding flash that knocks you for a loop. And
all the senses.
All the senses. It just
because the other one
unhorses you.
I want to show you a sort of a dispassionate survey. Now, will you please stand back and take a look at this? Because I want to show you.
From my viewpoint,
I want to show you. So that the other thing, the epiphany, the instant revelation is total sensory.
See with perceive.
And perception has to do with all the senses and not seeing.
Well, I mean, in the sense that when I say, do you see this, I'm just...
But don't you know how often people say, but do you feel it? Do you really get it? I don't think you're getting it. You know, this feeling meaning you can see it, but are you getting it? And this digging it, you see the new term, dig it, man, means all the senses.
Yeah,
I think we might take a moment to do a little survey of our situation here and in view of what we ought to be doing in next time or two. I think that there's something to be said, Tony, for going, what we do with poems and paintings is to follow the evolution of space from through the Middle Ages, Renaissance, Baroque, then the 19th century discovery, or the 18th century discovery of realism, and like Constable and Hogarth,
and then the Dickensian type of realism. And then we get into the 19th century with Romantic.
Romantic paintings. And I think the Romantic period actually would be a very interesting one to handle. Who was it?
Ingres we have and various people.
Remember, who is the fellow we read? The Sublime and the Beautiful. Remember this distinction in
Oh, yes, Ingres? Lessing.
No, it wasn't Lessing.
That's Burke on the Sublime and the Beautiful.
That's right, Burke, yeah.
But Lessing was on the his romantic back view of classical art.
That's the Laocoon thing.
The Laocoon. But the we have, you see, all this. We do this fairly careful spatial analysis of the stages of Renaissance discovery, first of single visual space, then the Baroque discovery of dual visuals. They discover simultaneously the point of view of the sitter or the viewer and the light source. They use two points of view in their work. The light source as a point of view and the viewer as a point of view, which creates that weird aura of the Caravaggio's, that haunting quality. You endow the object with an aura by giving the light source the authority of the viewer. So we have some pretty exciting stuff, and it comes out in the poetry and the painting beautifully, simultaneously. But I don't know how much of it we should use. Do you think we ought to do the whole run?
I don't know what the purpose of the record as such is. It to support the visual things you have?
No, I think the object is to allow the as much as possible to create a platitude that will stand on its own bottom, or sit on its own side, and be usable. Turn on its own table. And that was one of the crazy metaphors last night in this round table. Let Mr. Kennedy have the floor.
Yeah.
These guys using a microphone and talking about giving guys more floor space. I think the object is to reveal as much as possible as we can. Now, don't you think, Tony, that if you listen to these tapes, that you will think of sound effects that could amusingly enhance?
I think in certain places, yes, and other places, no.
Okay.
Yes, in certain places. I think
a great deal of it you could just throw out. But the idea is to, after all, we have a book coming out. The reader can have these platters. After all, it's an educational book. It's intended for schools, colleges, and everybody. The platters could have at least the same audience as the book.
But they are a more informal enrichment, actually.
Why are you making something for the schools if the schools aren't going to be here?
Just a moment. The education has become the biggest business in the world. Software.
Yes.
The hard schools are hardware.
Yes, but
the new education is software. Just electric circuits.
Well, when you say just electric circuits,
I mean electric information as recorded here, as broadcast by radio and TV. No, this isn't hardware anymore. That which is tied to circuitry is not hardware. This is because it's an extension of the nervous system. It's an extension of our nervous system. In a certain degree, yes. But you can see that it's possible eventually to dispense with it and have the image without that little box. Yeah, because you used to crank it.
No, I mean,
as it became electric. Look, most technology is hybrid. Did you ever know that the internal combustion engine was a mixture of gunpowder and electric circuit? The old musket. The explosions in the cylinders were based on the old musket, crossed with electric firing systems. Now, that's hybrid. Most technology is hybrid. This is hybrid. That's hybrid. Our schools will continue to be hybrid, except that they have books are hardware. Print technology is hardware. The photograph can be a hybrid insofar as it uses electric means.
I'm curious, why do you call the book hardware?
Because Gutenberg technology, movable types, is the prototype, the very matrix of all assembly lines. You'd never have had a motor car without Gutenberg.
And furthermore, of course, the book allows for the dispassionate kind of survey on it, which separates it from being literally an extension of man. This is an extension. The book is not. The cultural attitude toward the book was that it was a separate thing, just as for 500 or 600 years all art was a separate thing.
Yeah, it was not part of life. You spoke of art as if it had some...
See, you can say this, I'm just trying to understand this, you can say this is an extension of man in that it's taking anyone's ear in Europe that's going to hear you to that point. And his ear is now there, and we can, through the record, transfer what he can hear.
Well, the telegraph, the telegraph extends our nervous system. Our nervous system is electric, you see. Software. Because the moment you return to the auditory, you're in software. They're preprint. They're pre-technology. They harp. Aloud. Aloud becomes, the talking page becomes software.
Sure, because the recipient mind is highly involved in this in a very different way than it's in the book.
The harp, the Pete Seegers, software.
The hardware being the razor and the software being the...
The software is a term from computer technology. It never came in before to a computer. They mean programming. Environmental programming by circuit. It isn't really content, though.
The
programming.
Yeah,
but the programming tends to go over hybrid style over other media. As, for example, movies on TV. That's hybrid. Movies are hardware. TV is software. The camera, the shutter, hardware. TV has no shutter. No hardware.
How are you using the word hard and soft?
Oh, hardware just means... visually organized spaces, visually organized technologies. Fragmented. Hardware is fragmentation. The electric is integral. Solitary. Specialist. The hardware is specialist, software is involving. Total. Integral. The integral dissolves.
All right, now you say the radio is.
Nervous system. It's electric software.
Yes, but you spoke of radio not being as involving as, say, the TV.
No, you step out. The sound, radio tends to permit a high intensity of sound, a high definition of sound. And when you get the higher the definition of the image, the closer you go to hardware.
So the
pop
music today is becoming hardware?
No. Because you pluck instruments. You sing, you relate it to the voice, the spoken word again.
It's becoming an auditory,
acoustically
oriented music, as opposed to a print oriented
music. That's right, like you're going back to Homer. Pre-literate. Literacy is hardware. Handwriting, that's hardware, not parchment. It's fragmentation, specialism.
I was listening to some tapes of Alan Lomax the other day, a primitive dance rhythms and so on. And these apparently are quite extemporaneous.
Why don't we put this on? Why don't we run through this that we've just been through with you, Tommy? The difference between hardware and software. And you raising the questions.
All right. Okay.
Because I think that's very important for the listener.
Yes. Do you want to sit back or else help me move the microphone?
You want to Yeah, you just raise a batch of questions about hardware and software, and we'll...
I'd like to know what you refer to as hardware and software and why.
Well, are we on the air?
Yes.
Well, it begins Of course, with weaponry and extensions of the hands and feet, there's a sense in which the tools of man, clothing, any direct extension of the body is hardware. The spoken word, speech itself, involves all the senses at once. Hardware tends to fragment and specialize the separate parts of the body, as shoes, as knives, as wheels. These are fragmentary extensions of the body. Speech is not a fragmentary extension of man. Speech is not hardware. Speak that I may see you. Is an old...
What's the word hardware?
Oh, well, it's a recent terminology from classified catalogs of industrial... It's industrial.
Is the hardware store a hardware store because it has catalogs that you can select material from?
No, because it offers extremely specialized, separate, fragmented objects. That is hardware. The integral circuit of the electric is like our nervous system, without fragmentation. It is approaches the condition again of speech and of unity of man and involvement. Now, hardware, a speech is not hardware because it involves, it is not fragmentary and specialized. When it approaches the written form, then it breaks down into visual characteristics and components that are fragmentary, and to that extent, you get civilization and hardware. Civilization is based on hardware.
Yeah. Of course, the point where you can take speech and put it into a book and create an object which exists in vacuo, as it were, at that point you've got hardware, because it is not necessarily an evolving principle.
It is not the integral nature of the spoken word. But again, with electricity, the spoken word, Pete Seeger style, or in just plain talkie style, this again returns us to the autonomy, the integral quality of the involved spoken word. And this is not hardware. Speech is so rich, so deep, every word contains all the senses at once. The Greek word for word is mythos, mythic, involving the totality of man. The very idea of the word, the logos, is so involving of all the senses and of all knowledge that it has an integral character utterly alien to hardware. Hardware is specialism. It consists of written, the quill, parchment, wheels, knives, shoes, weapons, clothing, all kinds of specialized ways of extending and amplifying our physical powers.
So the word is really exemplified by the Eastern idea of the word om, which contains all possible vocal sounds.
And all words.
And all words.
Yeah. Now, if you ask where the word hardware came from, it is an antithesis to the software word invented by computer technologists. The computer people, for just lack of any other vocable, hit upon software for programming of the nervous system into new environments. They have the power with the computer to create new environments really made of our nervous systems. And since it is integral, such an environment is integral, total, it cannot be called hardware, which is specialist and fragmentary, as a railway is, or a postal system, or a bureaucratic organization of officials, hierarchically specialized and structured. The organization chart is very much the product of writing and hardware. The organization chart today dissolves. That's why the students will not bear having President Kirk around. They don't want any hierarchies. They want to get involved in the process of decision-making, directly and totally. That's why the old civilized organization of separate private entities with separate private specialist powers will not bear up against the software integral instantaneous environment. So the interface between the old hardware and the new software has frantic and frenetic qualities. It wipes off the personality or images of the individual kid growing up today. the ordinary child today growing up in a software environment and facing a hardware educational system can't bear the interface, the abrasive interface of these two contrasting systems too much for him.
Who's our friend Marshall? Not Peter Drucker, but the other fellow that we know very well.
Bernie Mollertheim?
Bernie Mollertheim. Do you remember his story in his book, 10 Years of Management, Revolution, or whatever the name title was, where he tells the story of the Polaris, where the organizer, on top of the thing, instead of setting up a hierarchical principle in terms of production of this missile, set up a series of sort of transparent overlays of organization.
Cells?
One was concerned entirely with communication, as a matter of fact, making sure that everybody knew everything that was pertinent to their particular job, and also ensuring that all the possible information from around the world could be fed into this organization. So it's a totally different principle, I think, of organization, and very oral and very tactile, kinetic, and not visual in the hierarchical sense.
Well, the old image of organization used the term staff in line, borrowed from military structures. And military structures were the sort of acme of literate hardware extended out into the aggressive world of operations. And staff in line won't hold up anymore under electric conditions when the people lowest down in the hierarchy can have access to just as much information as the president of the company at the same moment. That's what's creating such a mess in our political lives. With TV, every night becomes an election night.
A very funny example. The fact that the worker for the company, electrical information coming in on teletype has availability to the same information that the boss has.
Except, Tony, that the boss doesn't have time to pay attention to it, whereas the lower down character does. And their boss is increasingly expendable and is increasingly a dropout. The presidents of organizations of all sorts are now useless, non-functional entities. They don't have enough time to know what's going on. They're not involved.
Software eventually displaced all hardware?
We are at this moment listening to a police siren, which creates a strange environment of frenzy and alarm, pure software, and totally irrelevant to the environment that we live in.
But that's a sound that does create its own space. That police
very siren. Involving.
Yeah, creates a space around itself.
The guys are going to have a Coke or a cup of coffee somewhere, so they turn on the siren. And the principle of software as an extension of our own nervous system, I think, will stand up when you consider that all hardware, all weaponry, all tools and instruments are extensions not of our nerves, but of our physique, our skin, clothing, our arms, knives, hammers, saws, swords, spears, and of course, when weaponry goes into very high definition, clothing goes into very high definition, you have medieval armor.